Hello. On this week's program, David Patrick Stearns introduces us to Yannick Nezet-Séguin. Philadelphia audiences have been getting their first glimpse of the young French-Canadian conductor leading the Philadelphia Orchestra in works by Rachmaninoff and Tchaikovsky. Jason Pfeiffer visits the Lantern Theatre Company as it stages a new adaptation of the classic Nikolai Gogol play, The Government Inspector. Tom Keels uncovers Philadelphia's history as a brewery town and explores the city's current beer-making renaissance. And Susan Lewis profiles Andrea Baldeck. The in-demand fine arts photographer is featured in three current exhibitions in the Philadelphia region. Today's program is dedicated to Catherine Stearns, who died Sunday, age 93. She was the mother of David Patrick Stearns, to whom we offer our love and condolences.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Don't tell Charles Dutoit, but the Philadelphia Orchestra appears to be having a raging extramarital affair with a much younger man. In fact, a Montrealer who counts Dutoit, who formerly led the Montreal Symphony Orchestra, among his major role models. The conductor in question is Yannick Nezet-Séguin. He's 33, though he looks 16, is nowhere as suave and statuesque as Dutoit, but he's liked, sometimes adored, by virtually every orchestra he conducts. The French-Canadian has headed Montreal's No. 2 Orchestra for 8 years and has recently become chief conductor of the Rotterdam Philharmonic and principal guest conductor with the London Philharmonic. Now he's visiting Philadelphia for a trio of concerts that concludes tonight at the Kimmel Center. But the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns reports that with the conductor's stomach flu and snowed in flight, the debut might not have happened.
American Airlines baggage representative, please come to the baggage claim area in Terminal A East for passenger assistance.
It's a balmy late Tuesday night at the Philadelphia Airport F Terminal, where conductor Yannick Nezet-Séguin is hours late on the eve of his first rehearsal with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Illness kept him at home in Montreal an extra day. Snow and freezing rain grounded his flight interminably. One of the most important engagements of his still young career would seem to be turning into a cliffhanger.
Excuse me, Yannick.
Yes.
David Stearns.
You're here. Here.
Yes, I am.
You survived. You survived and you decided.
Yes. Yeah. Come here, I want to show you something.
I walk him over to a lighted sign that hangs over the security checkpoint entrance showing the Kimmel Center, where he will conduct.
That's where you're going.
That's great. Okay, that cheers me up.
Yeah, have you been there?
No, actually.
Oh, okay.
No.
Okay, well, somebody said it looks like a giant slinky, you know?
No, it's great, yeah. I feel. But I mean,
as we headed into the limo, he filled me in on all the heady activities coming his way of late. He'll conduct new productions at the Metropolitan Opera the next 3 seasons, in addition to his 8 weeks in Rotterdam, 4 weeks in London, and as many weeks as possible in Montreal. That's where he has enjoyed the unique opportunity of making his career in his hometown with the full support of his parents, a pair of retired teachers, plus his 3 cats. He's a compact, hardy, sometimes spiky-haired Quebecois who loves a cold beer after a performance, has none of the typical conductor imperiousness, but seems to have no problem inspiring musicians to follow his lead, so to speak. The Rotterdam Orchestra had the charismatic Valery Gergiev for years, but after only 3 programs with Yannick, the Dutch don't bother much with his last name anymore, he was unanimously voted in.
I remember in the second visit feeling almost shocked by how insistent and how extraordinarily intense these people were. I remember one of the violinists, extraordinary lady, who just took me by the shoulders and looked at me and said, "You belong to us."
It was that can be rather frightening.
Yes, it was frightening. It's a very intense group.
The Philadelphia Orchestra liked this young conductor right away, but often he'll be in his first rehearsal with an orchestra and wondering if the group likes him at all, while the management is already negotiating his re-engagement. Amidst all of this, his anchor is knowing what he wants with the music and going after it.
That's the most difficult thing, to try and be yourself and natural. And of course, this will be a lifetime journey for me. However, I always am amazed at how I am welcomed. And I never feel that there's this, or not even for very long, there's this attitude of who's that kid and what does he want? Who does he think he is?
Sizing up Yannick Nizet-Séguin takes a while, partly because the only other American orchestra he's conducted is the National Symphony, and his recordings with Orchestra Métropolitaine du Grand Montréal have been hard to find up until recently. His repertoire is a little crazy. He'll conduct a Nino Rota film score as a concert piece, but lest we think he's a young man in a hurry, he conducts some of the most contemplative Bruckner ever. His pedigree isn't typical. Much of his training was in choral music conducting at Westminster College in Princeton. He has performed a lot of Bach that other conductors save for old age. So you're not surprised to find that one of his mentors was the guru-like conductor Carlo Maria Giulini.
I was aware what he was creating was magic, and I was aware that it was ridiculous of me trying to put some kind of analytic organization to something magic. However, that's what I was trying to do. So I was trying to copy Bowman's. I was trying to note everything he would say. But when we had our private sessions, I would always, now that I look at this, I feel almost ashamed, because I was always talking about very young conductor problems. And what was disconcerting is that he was always treating me as a colleague and getting the answer back in myself and not him, in a very clever way, but in a very such a respectful way, which in the end gave me a lot of confidence.
That confidence, plus the fact that, having decided to become a conductor at age 10, he's more seasoned than he looks, Yannick Nizet-Séguin occasionally seems to conduct himself into a corner. Sometimes, one of his interpretive ideas will gather so much intensity, such as in this live Rotterdam performance of Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, that it's hard for him to find his way back to the overall flow of the piece.
I mean, I've never felt that, oh my God, what have I done? It's out of control. I've never felt that. But I felt sometimes that, yes, I was trying that shape. It informed me on, I thought I would explore something more about the piece. And then the next day I decided, no, recently we did four times Beethoven 7, and I thought the orchestra, like every orchestra, was a bit dragging in this. So I decided this would go really quick. And it worked for one night, but I was well aware then that, is it really what I feel is really the most true to the piece? No, I think I went overboard. But it doesn't matter to go overboard one night, in the grand scheme of things. And I'm glad we did it together. And the next night, it was more organic.
Classical people agree, in theory, that such risk-taking is necessary to keep the great masterpieces living and breathing. Surprisingly, few conductors can actually get away with it, at least as well as Nizet-Séguin does. It's always wonderful to have a talented young conductor in our midst. One German critic called this one Das Wunder Yannick, and this one, indeed, seems to be something that the world needs.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Yannick Nizet-Séguin conducts the Philadelphia Orchestra in Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2 with André Watts and Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 6 in the final concert of this series this evening at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall at 8.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The Lantern Theatre Company in Philadelphia celebrates its 15th anniversary season this year, and at the heart of the theatre's lineup is a play that's celebrating its 172nd anniversary. Over the years, The Government Inspector by Russian author Nikolai Gogol has undergone many revivals around the world and has been adapted for film, television and opera. Now, as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, The Lantern is offering its own new translation of this satirical play.
Nikolai Gogol is renowned in the world of Russian literature. The prose style of his novels and plays was groundbreaking in the early to mid-1800s, setting the stage for other Russian fiction writers like Tolstoy and Dostoevsky.
Scholars would tell you that he is kind of the father of the Russian realism.
Armina Lamana, who was born and lived in the Soviet Union until she was 13, translated Gogol's Government Inspector for the Lantern Theater. Rather than use an existing English edition, the company wanted to start from the Russian original to get the most accurate sense of the playwright's vision. It took only about a month for Lamanna to draft a new English version of the five-act comedy.
I did a verbatim translation. I did not change any of the idioms. It was me, dictionary, and the Russian version of the play.
The story, which Gogol wrote in 1836, centers on a small Russian village that's just learned of an impending undercover visit from a government inspector. The news throws the townspeople into a comical panic as they try to cover up the lies and corruption of the local province. Past productions of the government inspector typically used large numbers of actors to represent this community. But according to the play's director, David O'Connor, this wasn't an appealing approach for the Lantern Company.
Like many theaters in the country, many theaters in the world, it's difficult to afford a large cast, the cast that is, you know, that the show asks for in its original form. So we started to put together a vision that would allow it to happen with five actors. And what we tried to do is create a production where the five actors became a necessary, important part of the production, the fact that the cast was small and not just sort of an excuse.
Even though the play was written over 170 years ago in Russian, Armina Lamanna says her word-for-word translation didn't require much alteration to make sense in English.
David pretty much told me that, like, 99% of the time he had no trouble understanding even the Russian versions of things. You know, in English you'll say somebody kicks the bucket. If you translate it to Russian, it doesn't mean the same thing, obviously. Most of the idioms that were in Russian that I just typed in Russian, David understood because they're pretty straightforward.
Lamanna and O'Connor did work together, however, to condense the plot, removing peripheral characters and tightening up lengthy speeches. Altogether, about one-third of the play was cut. O'Connor says while Gogol was actually a concise writer for his time, the original version would feel long today.
Today's audience is able to absorb information much more quickly and are much more comfortable absorbing information visually, I would think. And so as such, they don't need as many words to get the point across. So if we did Gogol's play at full length, I think a lot of the passages would be repetitive and long and would not be necessary to get the same impact.
At the core of the government inspector are themes of corruption, facades, and deception, which play out in all aspects of the story, romance included.
It would be better if instead of poetry I spoke of my love, which from your gaze...
Love? I don't understand.
Why are you moving away? It would be better for us to be near each other.
Why so near? It's all the same apart.
Why apart? It's all the same so near.
Say that again.
Luigi Sotil and Sarah Sanford are two of the five actors that perform in the Lantern Theater's adaptation. Here they play Khlestakov and Marya. In the view of Sanford, the satirical tale of a 19th-century Russian town trying to hide its deficiencies offers a look at pitfalls common everywhere.
They are so afraid of what might happen to them that by trying to patch up the town in this ineffective way, they lead themselves deeper and deeper into lies. And it makes the situation that much worse. It's like a freight train that has to crash eventually.
This type of storyline and humor, according to David O'Connor, is still in use today.
Like the classic structure of a modern-day sitcom. Sitcom begins, someone is caught lying, they spend the rest of the episode trying to cover it up until they've been called out on their lie.
O'Connor points out that the themes also remain relevant. Bribery, corruption, and incompetence can be found in institutions and government bureaucracies everywhere.
That's why I think, you know, all these kinds of plays are always worth revisiting, because we look and see that the people 150 years ago, halfway around the world, are dealing with the exact same kinds of things that we're dealing with here and today.
With its new adaptation of The Government Inspector, the Lantern Theater reworked a classic tale to accommodate the limited resources of a small company. But while scaled down from the original version, the heart of Gogol's play remains intact and still resonates. And because, in truth, humans evolve ever so slowly, in another 172 years, this story will probably still resonate.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Government Inspector runs at the St. Stephen's Theater in Philadelphia through December 28th. Anyone who has ever attended a local sports event knows that Philadelphians love their beer. But what's less well understood is the role that Philadelphia brewers played in the social and architectural development of the city during the 19th century. Now WRTI's Tom Keels explores Philadelphia breweries, past and present.
The biggest mausoleums in West Laurel Hill Cemetery in Lower Merion belong to 19th century Philadelphia brewers. Stand in front of the old office, and the largest tombs in sight are two marble temples bearing the names Bergdahl and Poff. Behind the office looms the Betz Mausoleum, a German Baroque fantasy. Although the names Bergdahl, Betz, and Poff are little known today, these brewers were major commercial and community leaders in Victorian Philadelphia, according to Williams College history professor Michael J. Lewis.
Around these breweries, almost all of which were run by Germans, grew up large communities of workers' housing, social institutions, banks, which made these neighborhoods coherent groupings of German culture.
Philadelphia was home to breweries from its birth. When William Penn landed in 1682, beer was already being brewed on Dock Creek. But, says Rich Wagner, president of the Pennsylvania Brewery Historians, Philadelphia did not become a national brewing center until 1840.
John Wagner came from Bavaria, smuggled yeast from his brewery there, somehow got to Philadelphia. His brother-in-law helped him set up a home brewery.
Philadelphia's growing German population and the pure water from its artesian wells made the city a beer lover's paradise. In 1880, over a dozen breweries operated in Brewery Town alone, the district bounded by 30th Street, Oxford Street, 33rd Street, and Girard Avenue. By 1900, beer production had spread throughout the city. Rich Wagner recalls,
"When I was growing up and I would ask the old people, tell me about Brewery Town, and the common response was Philadelphia was one big brewery town. In 1888, there were probably, 96 breweries or 95 breweries in the city."
Many of these breweries operated in sprawling complexes of handsome brick buildings with stone and terracotta trim. Michael Lewis reveals that this uniform look was no coincidence.
Virtually every brewery in Philadelphia was built by one man, and that was Otto Charles Wolfe. And the characteristic look of the Philadelphia brewery, which is brick relieved with granite and terracotta trim, it tends to be a proud and haughty tower with a bold outline. This is the creation of Otto Wolfe.
Wolfe designed most of Philadelphia's major breweries, including Bergner and Engel, Poff, and Schmidt. But his masterpiece was the Bergdahl Brewing Company, built in the 1880s at 28th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue. Michael Lewis thinks that Wolfe's design was influenced by Frank Furness, the leading architect of the period.
To my eye, it's the best example of Otto Wolfe trying to do what Furness did with his banks, to create some lumbering, top-heavy, cheeky, arrogant proclamation of identity. The way the Central Bay corbels out reprises what Furness did at the Provident Life and Trust Bank. This is by far the most adventuresome brewery that Wolfe ever designed.
Today, these elegant structures have been transformed into condos. Another Otto Wolfe creation, the former Class and Nakod Brewery at 10th Street and Montgomery Avenue, now serves as a Temple University dormitory and office center. Rich Wagner explains that the survival of the entire Class and Nakod complex is a unique story.
What's interesting about this is it's a complete brewery complex. You had the large building over here, which would have housed the brew house, and then the vast fermenting and aging cellars. And then the next to the stable and garage would have been the bottling shop. And then behind this is where you see the smokestack would have been where you had the boiler house.
For Wagner, the beauty and solidity of brewery buildings is a testament to their owners' pride and faith in their own future.
These were their industrial castles, and they intended them to be here forever.
But this seemingly permanent world evaporated between 1910 and 1920, when it was hit by the double whammy of anti-German sentiment during World War I and the economic devastation of Prohibition, says Michael Lewis.
So in the scheme of Philadelphia history, it's a very short reign of power these brewers enjoy.
After Prohibition began in 1920, Brewery Town became a ghost town. While a few brewers reopened after Prohibition was repealed in 1933, Philadelphia was no longer a great beer town. Some abandoned factories still dominate their neighborhoods, like the Ortley Brewery at American and Poplar Streets, or the Poff Plant at Jefferson and 31st Streets.
Others have been demolished, like the giant Schmitz complex at 2nd and Girard, now an empty field. Berwich Wagner believes that Philadelphia is entering a beer renaissance.
We have Yards just opened a new brewery, Philadelphia Brewing Company. We have Notting Head Brewery and Restaurant. We have Manayunk Brewery and Restaurant. And we have Triumph Brewery. Oh, I didn't mention Dock Street. There's a new brewery out in West Philly.
At the intersection of Frankfurt Avenue and York Street in Kensington stands the Weisbrod and Hess Brewery, designed by A.C. Wagner in the 1880s. Today, this Victorian complex is alive with the sound of delivery trucks and the smell of fresh hops. Since 2001, the brewery has housed the Philadelphia Brewing Company. Nancy Barton, co-owner of the company, found that recycling the 19th-century structures for a 21st-century business was easier than expected.
We bought this building in May of 2001, and it needed a lot of cosmetic work. But because the building was built as a brewery, structurally, it was perfect. It's brick and concrete, and you know, it was built strong and built to last.
She says she's felt great satisfaction in restoring the old brewery to its original purpose.
We bought the building, and all the windows were concreted up and boarded up, and it looked abandoned. So it is very rewarding and satisfying to look back and see what we've done to it and kind of regenerated it and put new life into it.
While Philadelphia may have far fewer breweries today than it had at its peak, it is still possible to appreciate the architectural beauty of its survivors. And it's still possible to relax with a tall, cool pint of a local brew, whether it's Philadelphia Pale Ale, Row House Red, or even Walt Witt.
WRTI's Tom Keels. Photographer Andrea Balda currently has three very different shows in the Philadelphia area. Photographs of trees at Morris Arboretum, abandoned structures at Abington Art Center, and a photographic expedition through the Himalayas at the Penn Museum. This medley of subjects is matched by the variety of twists and turns in Baldeck's own career. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores the art and the artistic journey of Andrea Baldeck.
The photograph is a study of forms. Rounded shapes of shades of gray gently balloon from the background blackness. White highlights glisten on swollen surfaces. Crevices deepen and disappear into dark folds.
You could say, well, it's really voluptuous, but what the heck is it?
It's a tomato. And Andrea Baldeck says there are so many different aspects to reality. She enjoys creating this kind of what is it moment, the kind experienced so often in childhood.
If I can do this in small ways with grown-up viewers, it's really fun. Some of it is to awaken the notion of what a tomato is. It can also be about exploring the contours and the abstracts and the way the light falls.
Tomatoes are just one crop in the literal and metaphorical gardens Baldeck cultivates, providing both nutrition and artistic nourishment. She also explores crusty barks of majestic trees and kittens hiding in the crooks of sumptuous sculptures of Venetian winged lions. She shoots sweeping landscapes and close-ups of seeds and beans. She catches moments in the lives of young children and wizened elders close to home and around the world. Her photographs are catching the attention of gallery owners and museum professionals.
I think she has an absolutely extraordinary artistic eye.
Jill Wakely is director of education at the Penn Museum, where she says Baldeck's photographs of northern India and Tibet tap into the museum's mission.
These images are all of the area from whence our artifacts come, and they portray not just objects and landscape, but they portray the living people.
In contrast, Baldeck's show of photographs of trees is at the Morris Arboretum, where Bob Gutowski is director of public programs.
Her photography, which is highly technical, but it's poetic. It's poetic in black and white.
Technical?
You have chemistry, you have light, you have the camera to work with as a mechanism. And the technical is getting the very best out of those materials in an expressive way.
I'm not much of a soft focus person. I like things to be crisp and sharp and really clear. Perhaps that comes from enough time looking down a microscope to want things to be really defined.
Looking down a microscope was part of the journey that led Baldeck to where she is today, on a road that was not always clearly defined.
As a kid, you know how you think you'll be able to do umpteen things in your life and somehow make them all magically happen at once. I started out thinking that I wanted to be either a botanist or a physician. I also wanted to be a professional musician, and I wanted to take lots of photographs.
Her horticulturalist father loved photography. Her mother played the piano. Young Andrea read books about adventuresome doctors.
Like Albert Schweitzer. I remember reading a biography written for children, which had all these wonderful stories and great photographs in black and white. And I thought, yeah, this is the kind of doctor I want to be. I can go into the jungle and I can do good, but I can have adventures and I can make photographs and it will be exciting.
Baldack studied French horn in college, then after a short stint teaching nursery school, headed to medical school with residencies in internal medicine and anesthesiology, specialties she figured would be most useful in impoverished or remote locations. Once in practice, she made time to volunteer at a hospital in Haiti, but it wasn't enough.
What I found was that I was working 10, 11 months of the year in the first world so that I could go a month or two to the third world. And so I realized my life was sort of backwards.
Baldack took a large step sideways, giving up medicine and picking up the camera. She worked with local photographer Douglas Meller, took assignments, and photographed everything that looked interesting. Eventually, through contacts from her doctor days, she went back to Haiti, where she ventured out of the hospital into the countryside, gathering enough material for her first book.
It wasn't quite the same immediate reward as, say, curing someone of malaria, but if you could allow the world to know what the need was in that place, there was a chance of getting much greater support for medical care.
Andrea Baldack now takes her camera nearly everywhere she goes, collecting photographs, sometimes randomly, because she never knows which shots will one day speak to one another. Other times, she has a specific project in mind. Her trip to the Himalayas became a book and the show now at the Penn Museum, where the images depict multiple facets of ordinary life. Penn Museum's Jill Blakely says capturing these images of living people is a special art.
She's always the observer. She's either very still and very quiet and very unobtrusive when she takes these pictures, or people are so comfortable around her because some of these spontaneous moments she catches are really beautiful.
They include young monks getting water from a cooler and children at play blowing bubbles. Her photographs invite the viewer into a life beyond the image, making the exotic seem familiar. They can also interpret the ordinary with a fresh perspective.
You can see the detail in these cedar needles. You can see the background as you look through these droopy boughs, and you get a sense of time.
Bob Katowski, who spends his days among live trees at Morris Arboretum, says he is nevertheless drawn to Baldack's still photographs of, well, trees.
I know some of these trees. I know this blue atlas cedar very well. I've seen it thousands of times. Here I see it in a new way, and part of the black and white helps to do that.
In a world of digital color, Andrea Baldack loves black and white photographs, which she develops in her darkroom. The absence of color, she says, reveals form and contour, light and shadow, texture and contrast.
And very often, there is more meaning and emotion in the picture. If it's a portrait, what's behind the eyes? What's going on in this face? If it's a landscape, instead of looking at the blue water and the green trees, you're looking at the way the shadows fall and the smoothness of the water and the roughness of the rocks.
Truth, beauty, and meaning in life can be in the details.
What it means in terms of photographing out in the world is that you can have a lot of people looking at you as though you have lost your mind because you're photographing peeling paint on the side of an old building or something strange, you know, some detritus that's left on the sidewalk. And I've had people come up to me and say, you know, the view is that way.
In Baldack's work, the view is everywhere, from the underside of an uprooted tree stump to the fleshy inside of a pumpkin, from crumpled bills left as an offering on the toes of a giant Buddha, to a Tibetan newborn swaddled in a yak-skin coat.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Andrea Baldack's Presence Passing opens today and runs at the Abington Arts Centre until December 31st. Himalaya, Land of the Snow Lion, is at the Penn Museum through March 8th, And the texture of trees is at the Morris Arboretum through next September. And that's it for now. This week's program was dedicated to the memory of Catherine Stearns, the mother of David Patrick Stearns. She died aged 93 on Sunday. We offer David our love and condolences.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.